Welcome back to the MJA podcast. I'm Kate Swanell. Our topic today is chronic fatigue syndrome, and you only have to look at the comments section on any article about CFS to know that there is a lot of debate on this topic. Professor Andrew Lloyd, who is director of the University of New South Wales Fatigue Clinic, and exercise physiologist Carolina Sandler have written a narrative review of chronic fatigue syndrome for the MJA, and it has already generated a lot of debate among both the academic community and the patient advocates. Professor Lloyd is my guest today. My first question is a pretty basic one. What is the definition of chronic fatigue syndrome?
Oh, Kate, to be honest, that sounds like a straightforward question, but it's not completely. So I think the thing to emphasise is that this is a syndromal diagnosis, and that is, you know, a constellation of intrinsically subjective illness manifestations that plus the careful exclusion of alternative explanations for those manifestations. So all of that sounds pretty straightforward, not too different from migraine headache, for instance. But the extra difficulty is that over the last decade or two, there's been actually a series of consensus, what you might call case definition, but, you know, like syndromal diagnostic criteria.
Yeah.
And in the field, to some extent, more amongst the community than amongst the academic clinician research folks, there's a bit of debate about what you might call the best definition. I can say with confidence, though, that it is clear there are some core symptom domain. I think all the definitions would agree that there's a set of symptoms that you need to make sure there's no other explanation for those symptoms by good history and examination, and that some appropriate, relatively short list of minimal, a short list of investigations is essential, and others as directed by history and examination. That bit's universally agreed to. I think also all the definitions appropriately put emphasis on what you might call the three cardinal symptom manifestations.
Okay, what are they?
So the first of those is, not unsurprisingly, it's fatigue.
Is it fatigue that has special characteristics?
Yes, it's important to say this is a subjective symptom complaint, so it needs to be distinguished from what in medical parlance we might call weakness, where there's a loss of force generation from skeletal muscles.
Right.
Which, if that was present, it would put the symptom into a traditional neurological domain. So this is subjective fatigue, and its characteristic is that in people who've developed this disorder, if in comparison to their previous healthy state, if they undertake relatively limited amounts of physical activity, that could be anything from doing some gardening to exercising in the gym, they get disproportionately symptomatically fatigued, and the symptom, that phenomenon, persists after the cessation of the activity. And it can persist for a long time, hours or even days. So that's a core element. And another thing that goes with all of the varied definitions is that symptom in particular, but I guess the symptom complex more generally, should be associated with disability.
Right.
That is a loss of capacity to undertake the previously usual work or study or household activity. Number two is a somewhat similar phenomenon in a cognitive sense. And what I mean by this is that what people report is that when they try and undertake what we might call concentration-demanding mental or cognitive activity, they experience what you might call a cognitive fatigue. In practice, we would more typically describe it as increasing problems with concentration and attention and executive function. So thinking in an abstract sense about a problem or a challenge. So all of those things become more challenging after sustained concentration demanding activity. And again, there's that disconnect where, you know, doing some study for an hour or so, or listening to a lecture or reading a book, which previously was not a problem, after an hour or some short period of time with this illness, it triggers the symptom exacerbates and stays worsened for hours or even days. So there's like a physical disability and a cognitive disability.
Okay. What's the third core element?
The third one is a bit harder to define, but what patients typically report, I'm not sure what proportion of the healthy population report that they wake up in the morning feeling good, but I think it's a reasonable proportion. With this illness, patients typically report that their sleep becomes a bit more fragmented. They feel as though it's become more patchy, and it's got this distinctly unrefreshing quality. Right. They just wake up feeling like they haven't recovered in the slightest. That phenomenon, each of those phenomena has been thoroughly investigated for what you might call alternative traditional explanations.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the physical fatigue, it's clear there isn't any muscle weakness. The cognitive difficulties, it's clear there's not a traditional neurological disorder like mm-hmm. a dementia or MS or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And in the sleep disorder, sleep studies are pretty unremarkable, actually. They're all subjective complaints. And then in addition, somewhat more variably between patients, there are a range of other symptoms. And there's a sort of a long list of those, but some of the more common ones would be muscle aches and pains without any hot, red, swollen joints, sore throat without much defined, headaches. Sometimes, we might talk further about this, but sometimes some disturbance of mood. And generally here, the best descriptor is irritability, something akin to the feeling people have when they have an acute infective illness, like influenza or something. I feel a bit grisly.
Mm.
And sometimes it's more than that. So sometimes it's more overt depression or anxiety.
So it's a diagnosis of exclusion, isn't it?
In part. I guess one of the things I've emphasised in this piece is that in a clinical sense, it is readily possible to become highly suspicious of this diagnosis if those characteristic triad, the
yep.
physical fatigue, cognitive difficulties, unrefreshing sleep are present and you can't find any other explanation. So the positive recognition of the cardinal symptoms and then secondarily the careful exclusion
business. Are there any lab investigations that can be done to help with diagnosis?
Nothing that's in a positive sense. So the only role for laboratory investigations is to exclude
right.
what you might call clinical conditions that could look a little bit like a fatigue disorder,
yep.
but could be missed clinically. So perhaps anemia, perhaps thyroid disease,
mm-hmm.
perhaps some otherwise unsuspected kidney or liver disease. They would be the sort of, or an inflammatory process, like,
right.
you know, a quietly evolving autoimmune disorder, like lupus or something like that.
Mm.
So the investigations are targeted to do those tests and to make sure they're all negative or normal.
I remember back in the early 90s, I was a sports reporter, believe it or not, and I was covering some basketball, and a very well-known local basketballer had been diagnosed with chronic fatigue. And in those days, everybody kind of rolled their eyes and went, oh, yeah, you're just a bit tired, Frank, you know, and nobody can give you a decent diagnosis for anything else. It's just, you know, whatever. Is that still happening? Is that sort of stigma or disrespect of the diagnosis, in a sense, does that still happen amongst doctors and other practitioners dealing with patients who think they've got this?
In a slightly positive sense, I'd say things have improved a little.
Good.
But there's a long way to go.
Mm.
And in fact, one of the messages from the review is really aimed at general practitioners,
great.
Really to encourage them, to embolden them, so to speak,
mm-hmm.
to make the diagnosis. Because there's a couple of surveys of general practitioners that have been done internationally that say the majority of practitioners say, yep, I recognise this condition is a valid diagnosis and, you know, it's something that we should identify and manage. But in practice, very few clinicians actually do that. And so the average interval between onset of illness and diagnosis is generally in excess of a year. And so that just means people have, you know, patients have typically been to a fair few doctors and been either the doctor's too cautious to make the diagnosis
mm-hmm.
or not confident enough or alternatively doesn't believe in it. But I think it's more the former. And so there's a sort of a message in my article to try and encourage GPs not to worry about any of the minor variations in the so-called diagnostic criteria, but just to run through that process of recognising the positive characteristics, take a history, do an examination, do a limited set of tests, and actively participate in diagnosing the illness, and then secondarily thinking about how we manage.
Do we know what causes CFS, Andrew?
Yes, we know something. So what we know is that the only recognised trigger for the onset, and it's part of the reason it's something that I have a clinical research interest in the disorder, is that it's infectious diseases.
Yes.
And what I mean by that is a whole range of acute, predominantly viral infections.
Yes.
Are well documented to be the trigger for the onset of the condition. There's a reasonably well-known study that I conducted here in Australia called the Dubbo Infection Outcome Study, which identified that glandular fever caused by Epstein-Barr virus, Ross River fever, a mosquito-borne infection causes rash and arthritis, and actually a bacterial infection called Q fever, caught from cattle and sheep in particular, common in the bush. Each of those three is actually a trigger for the onset of a subsequent, what we might call post-infective fatigue syndrome, that when we evaluate patients after 6 months of ongoing symptoms, about 1 in 10 of the original group with the acute infection will still be crook with a what would be diagnosed as a chronic fatigue syndrome or a post-infective fatigue syndrome.
I mean,
and as it turns out, there's a range of other acute infections that are not quite so systematically, but have been closely linked to the onset. So everything from influenza to even leptospirosis, which was another report. You know, so there's a range of infections, and their commonality is that they all have a propensity to cause pretty severe, you know, reasonably significant acute illness. Not just a cough or a cold or a bit of gastro or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
The more substantive acute infections.
I'm guessing it's too early to suggest a link between COVID and CFS?
I hate to say it, but it wouldn't surprise me because, you know, COVID falls into that category of, at least in some patients, a pretty significant illness.
Yeah.
It plausibly will be. And
okay.
So we need a prospective cohort study to tidy up and resolve whether that is indeed a significant outcome. One other thing to say, Kate, about the triggers for onset or the causative factors is that there really isn't good systematic evidence to implicate anything else. There's especially amongst the lay community, there's sometimes a notion that people who are, how to describe this, psychologically vulnerable, you know, so have a predisposition to mood disorder genetically or from their family background. That's, in that Dubbo study, not a risk factor for onset. Life stresses, you know, so if you are busy as hell at work or, you know, you're bringing in the wheat crop 24 hours a day for days on end.
Yes.
None of that is a risk factor for onset. Nothing else has been clearly implicated to be associated with the onset of the disorder. We might go on to talk about disease mechanism. One of the great opportunities that we had in the Dubbo study, and there's a couple of other international studies like this, is that you can picture the situation. We enrolled hundreds of individuals, 500, I think, into the Dubbo study.
Yeah.
And the great majority of them just got better from their infection reasonably quickly and neatly. You know, within a couple of weeks, they're well. And what that means is that we can do a pretty sophisticated, longitudinal, matched case control investigation where we would match every person who has had glandular fever, who's age 20, who's female or male, who develops a fatigue syndrome. We can match them to an individual who got better within a week from the same bug of the same age and the same gender and so on. And in that context, we've looked for the obvious things. So we've looked for, does the virus or the other pathogen persist? And the answer is unequivocally no. And is the body's immune response against the infection abnormally persistent? Something like an autoimmune disorder. And again, the answer is no.
I'm talking today with Professor Andrew Lloyd, who is head of the Viral Immunology Systems Program at the Kirby Institute, about chronic fatigue syndrome. His co-authored narrative review is available now at mja.com.au. Meanwhile, the MJA now has a dedicated COVID-19 section where you can find all our latest articles on the virus, and all of them are, of course, open access. Just go to mja.com.au/journal/COVID-19. Don't forget all our podcasts are also freely available at mja.com/podcasts or on iTunes. Back to our chat. So the mechanism is a bit of a mystery then.
Yes, and then there's a very large number of studies, not quite so focused on what I would call post-infective fatigue syndrome, okay. So that subset of chronic fatigue syndrome with a good documented infection at the onset, but the more broad label of chronic fatigue syndrome, lots of studies investigating all sorts of mechanisms, and that's been happening over a couple of decades.
Yes.
I would summarise all of that body of research by saying that in general we've learned an awful lot about what the condition is not.
Yes.
You know, so just to give you a few examples, it's not a muscle disorder. And I've already mentioned it's not a degenerative brain disorder. It's not an occult infection. It's not an autoimmune disorder. It's not a, although there might be psychological manifestations, it's not a simple psychiatric disorder.
No.
It's not a hormonal disorder. You know, so the list is pretty long in that regard. The trick, the challenge is working out what it actually is.
So tell me about treatments then. What's the evidence say about what works and what helps at least?
Yes, yeah, somewhat in the same vein, to be honest, KB. Mm-hmm. There have been many double-blinded placebo-controlled trials. I think the most recent systematic review, I think, had, or it's at least 10, it's like 30 or 40, and that's in addition to a much larger number of case series evaluating various treatments. And the summary, again, is that in treatments that are seeking to be the cure, you know, like I'll give you a penicillin for your strep throat or something like that, and two weeks from now you'll be well, nothing. So none of the agents better than placebo. That's a real challenge, actually, for general practitioners, because it means that we're in a, even for a condition, you know, at least for migraine, which was the example I was giving before, we've actually got pretty good treatments. You know, we've got a family of drugs called the triptans that are great for migraine, even though we don't perfectly understand disease mechanisms. So for chronic fatigue syndrome, no pill that's curative. On the plus side, we do have, let's call it management, which has got a good evidence base. And in some ways, I would describe this as what you might call just application of good principles of supportive clinical care. It sometimes gets labelled with the description of cognitive behavioural therapy and graded exercise therapy, sometimes CBT/GET. And what that package deal involves is, first of all, what I would say is for the general practitioner would be good symptom management.
Yes.
So if there's pain, it makes perfectly good sense to try and relieve the pain. If there is clinically significant depression or anxiety, it makes good sense to intervene with the strategies that we know are effective, which are either psychological therapies or pharmacological therapies for depression. And that is good for the depression. Doesn't actually, unfortunately, fix the fatigue, but it's helpful for the depression. And then what we know is that there's an interesting phenomenon, and this is leading on to the GET notion, where you could paraphrase the fatigue phenomenon as being something like an illness-imposed limited energy supply. And so the idea here is that if you're healthy, you've got a full barrel of energy for the day. And everything you do physically, cognitively, even emotionally actually, asks for a little bit of that supply, every single task or activity that you do. And they all come from the one barrel. And with this disorder, the weird thing is that it imposes a short supply. So the barrel's half empty already before you even start. It's a supply issue rather than a demand issue. And on the demand side, the equation remains the same. Each task physically or cognitively that you might undertake, it still asks for that same quantum of energy. But the trouble is that if you get to the end of the available supply, that's it. There's no alarm bell, but punishment sets in. And the punishment is this exacerbation of the fatigue and other symptoms that's triggered by relatively short duration activities. So the way we apply that paradigm is to say, okay, that's a problem. We can't fix the supply. We can control some of the symptoms. We can help manage mood. We can try and make sure your sleep routine is good. We can manage pain, et cetera, et cetera. But in addition, we should, in the first instance, balance the available supply with the demand. So that means what we'd call pacing of activities, do physical and cognitive tasks in short dose, short bursts within the constraints of the illness. And then we try and apply actually a combination of things. One we would might traditionally call graded exercise, which really is this program of cautiously escalating structured physical activities, either formal exercise or other physical activities, and a very similar paradigm for brain training, cognitive remediation, which we typically call cognitive exercise therapy, which runs on exactly the same paradigm. Just undertake, you know, half an hour of concentration demanding brain work. And if that's your limit, we'll do that for a couple of weeks and then we'll go up a notch. And the traditional pitfall that some GPs who are already trying to do this find is that they generally overestimate the potential to escalate. Pretty cautious, you know, 10% only increment at intervals never shorter than a couple of weeks. And that graded escalation, it has been that whole package I've just described, including that graded escalation, it's got a pretty good evidence base as being effective in improving symptom control and in improving functional status slowly over time.
The whole energy supply thing, does that suggest that there's something going on with the way the body is converting or producing energy? Is the body not using the supplies we give it by not turning it into the right amount of energy? Am I making sense?
No, I totally understand what you mean. If you can think about that, in some ways the easiest notion to think about that question is in relation to traditional skeletal muscle aerobic exercise. What I would say in that regard is unequivocally clear that muscle strength, endurance and recovery is absolutely normal in this condition, paradoxically. And the same statement, weirdly, applies to traditional performance characteristics like computerized cognitive performance testing for brain activity. So when you're really cut to the chase, you know, I'm yelling at you to keep, you know, walking around the block or jogging or whatever, you can do it in this illness. The trick is we believe that the problem is more centralized and in the brain. And it's more about the way the brain responds, perceives and responds to those normal physiological messages from the body. And so there's like a misperception. So we think of it as a central sensitization disorder. I mean, in the brain, it's become overly sensitive to normal messages. That kind of notion underpins the graded exercise and brain training thing I was telling you about, because it's what you could call a desensitization paradigm. Seems to work.
What research are you working on now, Andrew, in terms of CFS? Are you, wave a magic wand, what would you be looking at right now if you could?
So my own research interests have been moderately wide and varied in relation to this disorder, but with a particular emphasis on post-infective fatigue. And the reasons for that are that it does represent the most easiest identifiable, discrete, relatively homogeneous patient group in which to study, and then plausibly generalized to the broader label of chronic fatigue syndrome. So, for instance, a couple of the avenues in the disease mechanisms sense, like I was saying, we've already crossed off the list persisting infection, immune system disorder, etc. But we do have some evidence supporting the notion that genes, as in genetic makeup, might be important. And that makes some sense because there are a number of well-characterized inherited genetic variations which determine the severity of acute illness when you get an infection like EBV.
Mm-hmm.
Some of how crook you get is determined by your inherited genetic makeup. And it turns out that how crook you get is a predictor of how long you'll stay unwell with post-infective fatigue. So we're continuing to explore that. And the other two areas that we're interested in are, I do feel for the patient population that, like we were talking about before, that they commonly get a bit of a tough time in primary care. It takes a fair while to get diagnosed, etc. And that's a reflection of the challenges for GPs, but perhaps also a reflection of the need for better awareness, education, maybe some attitudinal changes amongst general practitioners to try and help them feel confident and capable of making the diagnosis and giving supportive care. So we've been developing some education programs and evaluating them.
Where can GPs find that, or is it not available yet?
At the moment, we've done it primarily for the providers that typically do that CBT, GET sort of program. So that's particularly psychologists, exercise physiologists, physiotherapists, OTs. So we've just finished a controlled trial of an online education program that we're about to publish and then launch that program, internet-based. The third avenue that we're interested in is trying to work, I guess you might say, with that only available treatment intervention, the CBT-GET program, and see if we can make it more effective. It would be fair to say it's got efficacy, it works, it's not curative, it's just somewhat helpful. And so there's plenty of room for improvement there. So, for instance, we're exploring the potential role of medications that might modify that post-activity exacerbation of fatigue. And there's some interesting drugs which act on the brain that might modify that the severity and duration of that phenomenon. And if that worked, you can see that that would really help us move forward in our desensitization program more actively and efficiently. Perhaps the only other thing is it's a sort of a socio-political comment.
Mm-hmm. Go for it.
and that is that I think, for better or for worse, I think we have to recognise that there is controversy in the patient community about this condition and about how the medical community responds. You probably know this, but there was a patient consumer group who lobbied the National Health and Medical Research Council to set up an expert advisory committee and then report to the CEO about what they, I think, rightly perceived as inadequate health service delivery and inadequate biomedical research for this condition in Australia. And so that happened last year. And in response to that expert advisory committee, the CEO has put out a targeted call for research, put forward some funds to support Australian research, and has also prioritised some of those things that I mentioned, like education, and actually they've also prioritised a health economic study to understand how big a cost this is to the community. It would be fair to say, though, in that process, it has become, if it wasn't already, pretty apparent that there are members of the consumer community that feel not well looked after by the health services and move into rather alternative realms, and as in non-evidence-based treatments.
Yes.
And also are very actively critical, not necessarily in a rational sense, but are actively critical of some of the mainstream services and the research programs. And so for better or for worse, I think we have to recognize that that is part of the community's response, something akin to climate change and denial versus acceptance. And so we have to recognize that and respond as well as we can to that as a scientific medical community.
Thanks for your time, Andrew. Really appreciate it.
Pleasure. Thank you.
My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.